You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Life is full of awesome what-ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is a podcast from comedianscomedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast. Hello there and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith and today I'm talking to Arthur Smith. I was a little bit overexcited when I first met Arthur and very keen to recount a tale of my own. So you'll need to bear with us for the first 5 minutes of this interview in which there's not a great deal of Arthur talking and there's quite a lot of me excitedly telling him a story about my brief involvement in his life many years ago. After that, however, we get back into a proper groove. So please be upstanding for Mr. Arthur Smith. Arthur Smith. Hello, thank you for agreeing to be on the
show. Stuart, I'm delighted to be answering the ultimate question, of course, of the stand-up is where do you get your ideas from,
yeah,
in a sense. And I was like John Cleese's answer to that is, he says, I buy them from a woman in a post office in South Wales, but I don't know where she gets them from.
We first met, probably unremembered by you, many years ago when you used to do the unofficial tour, the alternative tour of the Royal Mile.
Oh, that's right. Weren't you the ladder man?
My friend Pete was the ladder man. But as an ex-street performer, or then I think I was a street performer at the time, for me, Arthur Smith's alternative tour of the Royal Mile was the most unconventional alternative thing. There were no tickets, it was people would meet at 1 o'clock in the morning or something.
Yeah, well, the latest I ever did it, I did one year, it started at 4 a.m. and I always think, well, that was the latest and yet the earliest show on the Edinburgh Fringe ever. It still is.
Yeah. I remember the one that sticks in my memory particularly. I remember the one that sticks in my memory particularly is the one where Simon Munnery got arrested.
Yes.
Because myself and John Feely helped prevent a riot. And I remember because someone arresting Simon bundled him into a car.
Yes, that's right.
Someone else knocked his hat off. And it all went off because you had just got your cock out. And the pre-arrest.
Yes. How did you prevent a riot? I didn't know.
There were several people. I remember John took charge. John Feely, as a wonderful comic and street performer himself.
John, I haven't seen for years.
Yeah, I've not seen him for a while. Last I heard, he was doing kind of dinner cabaret in Germany, to a very high sort of level. But he kind of jumped on it, and I think, you know, he was around, as we say in street performing terms, during the 80s when it was dangerous. And so kind of went, oh, this is going off. So he was like, you know, sort of came, what does Simon want? Right, Simon wants everyone to calm down. So he and I were kind of turning back large drunk men.
Blimey, yeah. Because at that point, someone had taken me round the corner.
So to take you away.
Yeah, to take away the heat, as it were. Yeah. And Paul Munnery ended up getting arrested, I think because he had the megaphone, didn't he?
Yes, I think he did. Was he being a German exchange student?
Yes, he was. Yes, that's right. He used to do that. He did that several years running, a rather earnest German tourist. What was his name? He had a name as well.
It might have been Jürgen.
Jürgen.
Was it? There we are.
Yeah. It was like before Henning Venn had showed up to be a real German.
Yeah, absolutely. Henning's basically ripped off
Simon. And he used to do Nietzsche heckles, I remember. I felt terribly guilty about it. Well, I got arrested later on that.
Yeah, I think so.
But not because I went down, I thought, this is terrible. And I discovered Simon had been arrested. And I thought, well, it should have been me. Felt guilty, so I went to the police station
perform a swap.
Well, I sort of caused a bit of trouble, such that in the end they came and took me in and arrested me as well.
Yeah.
And I always remember them thinking, well, we've obviously got a hold of the Mr. Big here, Sarge. Where could he be? Let's try the waiting room. You know, it's a fair cop, Gov. But in the end, the Leith police dismisseth us. Simon got off because we had to go for a trial, you know.
I didn't know what had happened. Festival
trial, but it was Simon got arrested for a breach of the peace and possession of cannabis. He had a little bit of dope in his back pocket or something. I got arrested, as far as I can make out, for breach of the peace and possession of a megaphone, because it was 3 a.m., 4 a.m. possibly, and it was, but it was the festival, bloody hell. Yeah. Anyway, so then when we had to, or Simon, I had to go up and I was a witness in Simon's trial in January. I remember it was a cold January, we both travelled up. And
they allowed you to be a witness, that's brilliant.
Well, no, I was the last witness, I wasn't used to it. It was quite an interesting Well, it was Kevin Eldon was there, he got thrown out for sniggering during the... And then that's right. Then there was a cop who gave evidence, but I never saw this because I was like top of the bill, as it were, of the witnesses. And of course, you don't get to see the other people's testimony.
No, really, of course, that never occurred to me. But that would make a mockery of the whole thing.
It hadn't occurred to me either. But anyway, I got to the thing, and the first question they were asking, they'd asked, there'd been various people, what time did this event start? And Simon had said, I don't know what time it was, whatever it was. Say it was one, and Simon said one, and the cop said one, and I said two, so I got that wrong. And then they said, how did they take Mr. Munro away? Was it in a van or a car? And I said, was it a van?
No, it was a car. I remember the car.
And then it was, how many people were there left at the end at this point? I said, well, it was just finished. I just finished. It was only about 20. And everyone else had said 100, apparently. So I was the world's most... But then I did make a big speech about Munro was not a man who was looking to... And he got off, pleased to say. But I'm also pleased to be able to say... that I was arrested at the end of a gig, and there's not many people who can say that. You know, Lenny Bruce.
Yeah.
I was arrested, and I was once arrested before a gig as well. I think that's pretty cool.
Well, I mean, that's a kind of a documented thing amongst, and I keep mentioning street performing because that's, I mean, I remember that kind of outdoor. It had that sort of. Whenever I've seen you, you remind me in the best possible way of a street performer, given that
I'll take that as a compliment.
Yeah, oh, good.
I did street performing in my time, sort of, because I used to be in a revue troupe when I started out, and we used to go out busking. We used to play... We used to do this insane Italian acrobats routine where we had these big sort of leopard skin nappies, and we'd run around banging each other's heads with trays and shouting in bad Italian. And I remember doing that. We used to do that at Covent Garden a couple of times. I always felt an affinity with the street performer.
You've got a bit of previous.
And I've always felt that, you know, if I was sort of parachuted into China or something and woke up without really knowing where I was with no money, I would go into the streets of Shanghai and do whatever I could and raise, you know, 30 yen for a bowl of soup.
No, I'm sure you would. I'm sure you would. And I think that's coming to stand up. I haven't interviewed any street performers yet on the show, and I will do. But I think that is a constant amongst street performers and amongst comedians and clowns. That idea of if I got dropped somewhere, I could survive with these skills. Yeah. I don't know if that's true to all circuit comedians these days.
I think there's quite a few comedians who probably wouldn't really be able to do. I mean, you've got to be big, haven't you, in street? You've got to reach the back of the crowd. Yeah. You've got to do big gestures. You've got to... Well, I don't know, you know better than I. But my... And I mean, Eddie Izzard, of course, famously started as... He was the king of the mound, I remember.
Yeah.
And when he first came indoors, he was in a double act, so he wasn't really that good. And they were a bit too, you know, big and shouty.
Sure.
For a...
It takes a while to unlearn those kind of those things. But I think it's also about fearlessness. And I think, speaking, sort of addressing you as someone who half an hour ago was on stage, we'd just done a gig together at the Underbelly for Comedy for Kids in front of 320 odd screaming children. And, well, I did it in front of the children and you did it surrounded by the children.
I hadn't really planned much. But I had planned to crawl on. I thought that would make an unusual entrance. But beyond that, I hadn't really worked much. And it's fun with kids. Because, of course, if you offer... You know, I remember I used to do a lot of audience participation when I was in this review group, and we'd get people waving shoes in the air and doing all sorts. But, of course, adults have to be a bit nudged and bullied into it. Whereas, of course, you forget children, you know, they're well up for it. You know, you say run on stage, as I did, foolishly, and I suddenly had about 50 kids running around on the stage. It reminds me, I did a show once, again with this review company years ago, where we were doing a show that was, whatever it was, there was a Batman sketch, but it was aimed at adults. And it was about Saturday morning pictures, which no longer exist, but, you know, there was a time when children on a Saturday morning would go to the local cinema and there were special kids for children, special films for children. And we were pretending that we were enacting one of these. Anyway, so I was Batman, and we got booked as a sort of PR thing to play the last Saturday morning picture show in Edinburgh before the main event, before the film. Wow. So there were all these kids. And we started performing, and I mean, it wasn't exactly sophisticated, but it was a bit too adult for these kids, so we stopped it. And I stepped forward, dressed as Batman as I was, and said, right, which of you boys wants to fight Batman? Yes, and you will know, Stuart, from your experience, as I didn't, that every little kid in that room, every little boy put his hand up, and they formed an orderly queue to come up and punch Batman in the stomach. This was all at like 9 a.m. I'd been to bed all night. Jesus. Punched in the stomach by 100 little Edinburgh schoolboys.
And those 100 little boys, they presumably learnt a valuable lesson about not respecting authority.
Yeah.
Because I don't know that about attack symbols.
Yeah. I mean, as I was doing that, I was thinking, what sort of messages? I don't know if you think about what messages you're sending. I mean, you have to be a little more careful with children, I suppose.
So don't worry, from now on, from here on in, it's mostly Arthur and a lot less of me. I'll just be asking probing questions and then trying to shut up while Arthur gets a chance to answer them. This is a really fascinating one. I think this is a really invigorating interview today. We're talking about Arthur keeping it loose on stage, keeping the material fresh, but without resorting to talking to the audience. We're going to be discussing the idea of the fool and how Arthur sees himself fitting into that tribal need for a sort of shamanic comedic figure. And Arthur's got some fascinating... It's a very literary interview and a very poetic one. I don't think I'd realised before the extent to which Arthur really paints pictures with words. He talks a lot about writing without fear and about killing the cliché. And he also has a really interesting take on... In his language, really, he talks a lot about releasing the comedy from a subject or liberating a joke. It's a very fascinating, a very inspiring way to think about comedy as something that's sort of already there, waiting to be released. So lots of great stuff coming up from Arthur. Remember, the extra content from Sarah Millican's interview last time, that's still available at the moment at comedianscomedian.com/Sarah. And to get into that, you need to use your email address. It's all there explained on the form. You'll sign up to my mailing list, and then you can use that email address to download any other future goodies that I put up there. You can, in fact, as some people worked out, you can sign up, use your login to download the extra bits, and then unsign. A couple of people have actually done that. I'm looking at you, Luke Toulson. Unbelievable. And by now, if you're on the mailing list, you should have received the full lineup for the ComCom live show. But if you haven't yet received the lineup and you'd like to, you can join the mailing list at comedianscomedian.com and just click on the link on the main page there. So here are the guests in full, and I'm asking one listener question at each one of the live performances in Edinburgh, the live interviews. I'm asking for one listener question each for Alan Davies, for Rod Gilbert, and for any of my other guests. So send those in on the Facebook page. Have a look for us, the Comedians Comedian Podcast on Facebook. And if you join up there, you can suggest on that page your questions. You have a bit more room to do that than on Twitter, I think. So in no order, if you want the order, you've got to sign up to the mailing list. But in no order, and I'm very pleased to announce now some new people included in this list as well. We have Alan Davies, we have Rod Gilbert, Fred McCauley, Abandaman, Josh Widdicombe, Sarah Pascoe, The Boy with Tape on His Face, Terry Alderton, Pappies, and we also have, I'm so excited about these two, we have Eddie Pepitone. And if you don't know who Eddie Pepitone is, you might know who he is if you're a fan of Mark Maron's excellent WTF podcast. If you don't know who Eddie Pepitone is, Google him, watch his stuff on YouTube. He's amazingly good, hauntingly, howlingly good at just making beautiful, cosmic, lonely, beautiful concepts out of the most tiny, mundane things. So Eddie's going to be on the show, and Hannibal Burris as well, the wonderful Hannibal Burris, who stormed Edinburgh last year, and is also he's a writer on 30 Rock. So if you're a fan of that show, we'll be talking to Hannibal about that. So why not get on the Facebook page, send in your questions if you have questions for any of those guys, and if you're on the email list, then you will know when they're on. And remember, there are only 50 tickets. There's only 50 seats for each show. There have got to be 50 Rod fans and 50 Alan Davies fans in Edinburgh, so those ones are going to sell out. So if you want to know, get on the mailing list and book up quickly. As ever, you can tweet me at ComComPod and suggest guests for the show, for the podcast. We've had some great suggestions coming in. And if you're a comic with a big following who's enjoying the show, you can become a super goldsmith simply by telling your followers that it's a worthwhile listen. So thank you, those of you who've done that. I am going to do a newer act special and also a separate open spot special for people who are brand new or within their first couple of years. But both of those will be after August. That's it from me. Apologies for the third of this show. The sound quality is a bit dodgy because we had to move and there was a load of people chatting nearby. But I think it's still audible. It's good enough for jazz. It's good enough for me. Enjoy Mr. Arthur Smith.
Life is full of awesome what ifs and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Would you regard yourself still as a circuit comedian?
In some sense. I was in at the beginning of the circuit, and there have been periods I've been away, but I've always sort of, I wouldn't say I'm a regular circuit. I don't do kind of trawl around doing five gigs a week anymore.
Sure.
But, I am a circuit, and I'm pleased to be.
But the gigs that you do, do you find that you approach them with a similar, I don't really know what I'm going to do, and you just rely on the fact that you've got a huge amount of material that will come back to
some extent, yeah. I mean, if I'm doing it, I've also done a lot of one-man shows around the country. For them, I'm going to be more organised. I'm going to have a notion of I'm going to go from here to there and there, and I've got some music cues and blah, blah, blah. For something like that, I went on not knowing what I was doing for kids. But certainly if I'm emceeing, I'll always be a bit loose. And it's true, I do, at any moment, I can switch back to quite a large trough of material.
Sure.
And if I'm not feeling very inspired, there's certain things I'm always going to do But I like to keep it fresh. Although I don't like to spend too much time talking to the audience. It's interesting, I know that's an audience participation and chatting to the audience is kind of back now in a much bigger way than it used to be. Because when at the beginning of alternative comedy, there was a sort of general agreement that was a chicken's way out, that's what like the Americans did, you know. And famously, Tony Allen, who was like this sort of guru of comedy then, went and sat in the front row of an American comedian who was known to always do most of his act was, hello, where are you, what do you do, blah, blah, blah. And he got to Tony, he said, hi, what's your name and what do you do? He said, I'm Tony, I'm a comedian, what do you do? And this bloke sort of froze. And there was a general, and I'd come from doing review, which always involved a lot of audience participation, getting people up, blah, blah, blah. So there then became a period where it was, you don't do that. You know, that's a chicken's way out. You've got to do your stuff.
Sure.
You know, you can't just end it. It's easy to get laughs off the audience and blah, blah, blah. So I still feel a little bit of that in me, but I see now that's coming back a bit more. And I'm beginning to think maybe I'll go back to audience participation. For years, I used to come on and say, hi, I'm going to come on again and say, hi there, everybody, and I want you to shout back as loud as you can, fuck off, Arthur, I hate audience participation, which people duly did. But now I'm beginning to think maybe I'll go back to it a bit. I mean, the guy who won, was it a boy with tape on his face? And the guy who won the award last year.
Adam Riches.
Yeah, they're all just using people in the audience, aren't they?
Yeah.
But in quite a sophisticated way.
Yeah, absolutely. But it definitely seems to be in vogue at the moment. I remember we were having a conversation with a friend recently about how, like 5 years ago, 6 years ago, it was whimsy and it was taking on stage a graph that you'd drawn to do a joke about a graph. And some people did it well and some people didn't. And now it seems like the new thing on Vogue is clambering into the audience. So think of people like Ben Tarjay, who does that kind of Steve Martin, you know, picking the audience up and taking them outside, like the Doug Anthony All-Stars
might have done. Yeah, right, but you don't remember them, do you?
Yeah, I do. I do remember them. I never saw them live, but I saw them on TV.
They were great. They used to do a version of... they were really good singers. Heard it on the grapevine. That was just electrifying, I remember.
Yeah.
They were pretty cool. They used to come on my alternative tours. There was one of them used to take his clothes off and sing, I remember. Yeah. The tall one, what was his name? Yeah. Yes. Yeah, so, anyway, so I always, yes, but in a sense, doing my, you know, doing audience participation and doing visual stuff is not really my thing. I, you know, from a young age, I was interested in words.
Yes.
In a sense, words, I think, I mean, I can crawl around and, you know, and yeah. take my clothes off.
You're not afraid of those barriers,
no,
I think.
No, and thing, I think that's yeah. partly because when I started in comedy, I was in a revue troupe and we used to do that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It was an ensemble, whereas a lot of people just started as solo stand-ups. You know, they're not used to that kind of idea. And I'd done a bit of street theatre, but nevertheless, words, I mean, as a, you know, when I was 10, I was always writing. And I loved words, and I read, and, you know...
I'm keen to show off this quote, actually, because I did a bit of research about you, Arthur, because it occurred to me I've only seen you, like, in gigs here and there. I've never seen one of your hours, apart from that one that I was in, juggling kippers.
Oh, yeah.
Which, incidentally, the research threw up the fact that, apparently, you got nominated for the Malcolm Hardy Award...
Yeah, that's right.
...for the publicity stunt of offering £100 to anyone that would review. And I did juggle kippers on your stage, so you owe me £100.
No,
one gave it me. I didn't even realise that was part of the thing.
Oh, that's terrible. I'll tell you, did Bruce Dessau did it.
Oh,
I gave him £100. Oh, well, you
unbelievable. This is going very well. We'll sort that out afterwards.
I don't know how that could... I think maybe, but I think the Segway sisters had somehow embroiled you, hadn't they?
Yes, they... Oh, did they take a cut, did they? That would
maybe
be very
they
right
they sorted
then.
It away, those girls.
Okay. Okay, but this... So the quote is, and I found this on one of your blogs, on your website, which was an excerpt from your 12-year-old diary.
Oh, yeah.
In which you said, when I'm writing something... And it's very sweetly written. Yeah, it's very, you know, it's not sort of precocious. It's you go, oh, wow, that's a 12-year-old that really cares. You said, when I'm writing something interesting, I often go into a trance. I get so wrapped up in it that I do not hear anything except the sound effects of my composition.
Yeah, it's quite good for a 12-year-old, isn't it, really? Yeah, well, that's true. I writing was always a kind of escape and interest to me. I used to go, you know, my mother used to take me to the theatre a lot. It wasn't really telly then. You didn't. I read and read and read as a child, and I loved words and the shape of words, poetry. I love poetry, and sometimes on stage, I quite often these days begin to I'm reciting poetry. That isn't funny necessarily, nor mine come to that. Always, sometimes, because I've discovered you can have an electrifying effect with a beautiful poem. So, as a child, you know, and at that age, I used to kind of win, you know, essay competitions and things. I was, I loved writing and putting words together.
And did you? When was the first time you remembered writing something to be performed? Did that happen at the same time, or did you write your own sketches, or was there or poetry that you'd perform?
I can remember one incident, which I talk about in my memoir, where I must have been about 7 or 8, and the teacher came into their class and said, right, we're at the school, where our class is going to be performing Peter Pan in front of the parents at Christmas. And I was incredibly excited by this and went home that night and wrote Peter Pan. I wrote a show. I wrote the show that I imagined they would do. And obviously, taking it in the next day, proudly gave it to the teacher. I mean, I don't know what I wrote, but I'm guessing it wasn't actually sort of physically performable, probably. I don't know. Yeah, I'd probably read. So I'd written that, but the teacher said, well, we can't really do quite what you've written, but you can have whatever part you want. Instead, so in a sense, that was performing, yeah.
Okay.
Although I had written that. The first time I can think of something that I wrote, well, at school again, there used to be a school review, and I wrote an impression of, I wrote a version of what the English teacher used to say at assembly.
Okay.
So early on.
Like a satirical version of it,
yeah,
you mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, I was in these shows when I was about 12, and by the time I got to 13 or 14, I thought, well, I could write some of these, and then I did, and then by the end of school, I was kind of writing most of it.
And was that was, when you say review, that was specifically comic?
Yes, absolutely, yeah. I mean, like, I remember I wrote a Blue Peter sketch, you know, with, here's one I did earlier as a kind of catchphrase, and, you know, I can't actually remember anything about it, but I remember that it got laughs, you know.
I learned
once in an ad lib. I remember I was introduced by the chairman of the governors or something or other. You know, this is a grammar school in South London, and he looked down. He got the name wrong. He said, "And here he is, Mr. Kevin Pilkington." And like the audience at the school, boy, they all knew I wasn't Kevin Pilkington, so they all sniggered. And I came on and said, "I'd like to thank the chairman of the governor, Mrs. Doris Simpson."
Yeah.
So I had libs.
Yeah.
And got a huge laugh. Yeah. I remember thinking, oh, this is good.
Hang on.
Yeah. Since I wrote that, that was my first public ad lib, I suppose.
Okay. And were you, when talking about ad libs, were you funny socially? Were you funny amongst your classmates, or was it just a performance?
Yeah, I was, really. I mean, it might be nice to pretend I wasn't, but I was, I wasn't bullied particularly. But I recognised early that I had a talent. I was extrovert. I liked showing off. I had a talent for entertaining people, and that by employing that talent, I could get out of doing, washing up, or I could get out of the mundane jobs that didn't suit me by showing off. And in a sense, that remains to this day. You know, and every tribe will have the guy who, like the fool, who they don't... It doesn't matter if he's not gone out hunting, because he'll make us laugh later, kind of thing.
Sure. I mean, it's interesting you mentioned a sort of tribal idea of a fool, because you do seem to fit, and that might be kind of what I'm talking about if I talk about street performing or clowning. You do seem to fit, in my eyes at least, a kind of archetypal... You cut an archetypal character... Do you know what I mean? You seem like you're supposed to exist somehow.
I seem like I'm supposed to exist. Yeah, yeah. Well, I think it's like I'm very comfortable standing up in front of people. And of course, 98% of the world are absolutely terrified at that prospect. Mm. You and I are not. So, for example, I've spoken often at funerals. Occasionally with someone I didn't even really know that well.
Really?
Because people are terrified to speak, and terrified at funerals in particular, because they don't want to make a fool of themselves. They're overcome. And so in a sense, I feel that's my job in life, speaking at funerals. And that's a kind of archetype. I'm the scribe stroke fool stroke, and every little community they have one, even the small one, even like if you got just six people together, one of them's going to kind of be the fool that the other one's tut at, but secretly enjoy.
And is that something that you've pursued in how you're perceived, or how you expect to be perceived? I mean, at the moment you're wearing some very exciting kind of calico patterned trousers. You're often seen in last time I saw you had a turban on. It was very lovely.
Oh yeah,
or your black latex thing with this the lips. Is that where does that come from? Does that fit into that idea?
I've always been uncomfortable in what my partner calls when I am forced into the ordinary clothes, or the clothes that the ordinary people wear. I'm recognised that I'm a shambolic figure in some ways, and I cultivate that. But it's partly just because I'm quite chaotic in some ways, although quite orderly in others. But certainly when it comes to what I'm wearing and how I present myself, I'm never going to be the ordinary guy, really. Mm. I wouldn't be a very poor spy, for example, as a friend of mine who works at MI6 told me.
I'm just going to pause there to apologise to the listener, because it's starting to get quite loud around here.
I don't mind. They seem to be those Cuban dancers. They're not unattractive.
Yeah, I think from looking at the levels on this, some of it might be sufficiently in the background that we'll bash on, and if people need to
I have
put
a very
up with
clear you, voice.
Well, still, evidently,
I know
yes.
this because on the radio I was told this once. I remember hearing she was like, "Well, hold the microphone closer to the other person because Arthur's got a very clear voice."
Ah, I see. So I should have this closer to me because you've
Because of my famously clear voice. I'm on Radio 4.
And so how did Radio 4 come about? If for someone who's a kind of a chaotic person, you also have an establishment kind of... Or there's a place for you in the establishment.
Well, I think it came out because partly because I mean, I'd started stand-up, and I'd been in his reviews, but I'd written most of the reviews, and obviously I wrote most of them, mainly stand-up material, and I wrote a play in the late 80s, my first play. It was well received. And then I went on to co-write another play, and it was like a huge hit. It was called An Evening with Gary Lineker.
Yeah.
So then I became a playwright in people's eyes.
I see. And that's access of a sort, is it?
Yes, that means that, you know, if you've written a play that you're not even in, you know, that, yeah. which I wasn't, which is very successful, then you're a playwright. And then that, you know, that moves, you know, then people will think of you differently.
Yes, so, like you're allowed to be drunk in the bar because you're artistic.
Yes, exactly. But also from the point of view of Radio 4, it means you're more thoughtful than just a kind of gag merchant, you know.
Sure.
And then, you know, every now and then, you know, I could quote Dante or something, or it turns out I knew some poetry by heart. And then suddenly, I think in Radio 4, especially as I was, they're not known for people with my accent on Radio 4. So I was a useful kind of thing to refer to. Also, I fell luckily with Radio 4 because I ended up interviewing a lot of people.
Yes.
And in a way, it took me a while to learn that, but that is quite a skill in itself.
So did the play taking you into the radio and giving you that sort of the embrace of the mainstream, that sounds like it happened by accident, or is that, so it's not something you sat down and wrote, this is my career plan?
No, I'd always wanted to write a play. I'd written a school play of 20 minutes when I was at school. I'd written, when I was a student, I wrote a terrible play, because I found it the other day, because I went to the University of East Anglia, where I wasn't doing they'd just started the creative writers course, Malcolm Bradbury.
Okay.
And whilst I wasn't on that was a postgraduate course, the university did give the possibility that sometimes instead of an essay, you could write a piece of creative work. So thus, instead of writing an essay about the form of the sonnet, for example, you could write a sonnet.
Okay.
Which actually is a much better way of finding out about the form of the sonnet if you're trying to write one, I'll tell you. And anyway, so I'd written a play instead of half a thesis, and so I can't remember what the question was now. I don't think you can either. But whatever, I had some kind of, you know, I was always looking to write, and I'd always wanted to write plays. So yes, having established myself as a stand-up, I'm still always one of them, and I wrote this play, and people did, and it was a big hit. Actually, it's called Live Bed Show, and you know, it was nominated for the Perrier Award, as it was at the time, which was controversial because it was a play, but it was funny. But it was me and Caroline Quentin, and then a few years later, that went into the West End. So I was never, you know, stand-up is the backbone of what I do, I suppose. But I've always been interested in going to other areas and in writing. And, you know, I feel a bit disappointed in myself. I haven't written a novel, really. But I kind of got a couple half-finished at
home. Oh, that's half is a lot more than I think some people get.
Yeah. There's another tray full of 10th written plays novels or, and I've always been interested to, you know, I've never been ambitious in the sense of I've got to have money and fame if that's what, but I've been ambitious and I want to do that thing or try something interesting. I'm a risk taker to some extent, you know. I did a show called Arthur Smith Sings Leonard Cohen, where, you know, it doesn't sound like much of a night out. And I did a version of Hamlet. I did a stand-up Hamlet in the mid-90s.
Okay.
So I always had a slightly literary dimension to what I did.
So let's talk about the stand-up. Let's talk about writing stand-up. I mean, you're now in a position where you have a huge wealth of material, and you're responsible for some of the best one-liners in the business. I mean, some of your one-liners are really... Just, I mean, I'm thinking specifically, the one I always think of, the first one I always think of is the message from Midlothian Council.
Oh, yeah. Tuesdays and Fridays are rubbish days.
Yeah, yeah. I just...
Which is actually found comedy.
Yes, sets. of course. But found and framed and turned into comedy. It isn't comedy if you just leave it there.
Surprisingly, the number of those there are. You can find... lots of people notice, for example, I remember in the 80s, there was a sign saying... people with guide dogs this way or something. Mm. Of course, everyone in the world thought, well, how the hell can somebody who's blind read that?
Yeah, of course.
But there are other more sophisticated ones. If you change the context of something, it suddenly becomes alive with laughter.
When you were writing...
But one-liners, yes, because I've always, in a sense, there's a degree of poetry to a one-liner because, poetry, every word is, important. In a way that it's not so much with prose. You could change a few words of a Walter Scott novel, and that's about anyone would mind. But, you change just two words of a Shakespeare sonnet, and it's gone.
Yeah.
So, and a one-line is the same, as you know, it's got to be the thought passed right down to its minimum.
So let's talk about the process. I mean, do you still write one-liners now? Do they still crop up, or is that something?
Well, especially now Twitter's arrived. It's a good place to try them out. Yeah, I suddenly find myself writing puns again, and because you can sort of try it out on Twitter. I wrote the other day, I've been chased down the road by a maniacal cardiac surgeon. He's a man after my own heart. I mean, how do you write a one-liner? Well, I think it's probably different for everyone, but you have a thought that you feel is short enough, you can encapsulate it in a small number of words with an explosion at the end of it. And then you find a way of shaping it. And then, of course, as you know, you try it out and then works or it doesn't. You never really know, obviously.
Do you keep notes of things that occur to you? Are you a note taker?
I've got dozens of notebooks at home. And I think most writers, stand-ups, you're always, in a sense, you're always at work. Mm-hmm. There's always something. You think, there's a thought. Something will come up in conversation, or you'll overhear something. There's another whole world of overheard remarks that Alan Bennett and whatnot are masters of. I have dozens of notebooks lying around at home. I often find, I'll look at them sometimes, or I usually try and go through them every now and again and pick out what I've written. But of course, about a third of it, I've no idea what I meant. I've written down purple phone or something. What was that? I can't remember what it was. But I mean, I was thinking, in a sense, as regards your accountant, you should be able to claim everything as a writer or a stand-up, because potentially you're always, even when you're asleep.
I had this argument with a tax guy from Equity recently at the Chortle conference, which is effectively, a comic was asking him if you could claim for beer, because, being a fat, tubby comic absolutely. Was part of your...
I definitely, for example, I mean, that's an interesting area, writing when you're out of it, which is, I mean, you're never going to get the Home Secretary saying... the head of the British Medical Society saying that. But the fact is, sometimes if you're a bit drunk or a bit stoned, you can write, you've got a slightly different perspective, and you can write something that you wouldn't have been able to write sober. I mean, as we know, Coleridge and all those romantics are all out of their head on Loudenham.
Churchill won the war smashed. And I've heard George Carlin in an interview, in a recorded interview, describing writing the material and then getting stoned and going back and doing punch-up. And that being like a living part of his process.
Yeah, absolutely. So I always felt that you should be able to claim cannabis against tax. And indeed, I put that to my accountant once. But he seemed to suggest that there might be some problems with it. But I'm not suggesting you have to get pissed in order to do right stand-up.
Sure.
But
it does maybe take you into another frame of reference, another way of thinking.
And also what it does is, Henry Miller, the writer, used to talk about writing without fear. And, of course, you become more fearless when you're drunk, say. Sure. Not that I drink anymore, but... So they, you know, there's something to be said for that as well, as a way of liberating.
In terms of writing comedy, what is that fear, do you think? If we're talking about writing without fear, is it the fear of what you're writing not being funny? Is it the fear of it?
It can be more than that. It could be that it's embarrassing, that it's dull, that it's a cliche, that it's too abstruse, that it's too individual, that it's not expressing what you want. You know, because there's a long gap between what's going on in your head and what appears on a bit of paper. It's the fear of not getting that channel right.
Mm.
And right without fear is where you take a chance. Where, you know, in a sense, to explode a cliche. And in a, writing is always about killing cliches to some extent.
And, this is a jazz trumpeter we've employed to make this all the more poignant.
Playing the trumpet and talking simultaneously. That's a trick if you can do it. Hang on, listen to this bit, it's really good.
So we were talking about killing the cliche.
Yes,
that's the job of writing, is to describe a thing in a way that's never been described before.
Yes, exactly. Or even to crush the cliche. So, you know, if someone says I was over the moon, you know, that super cliche like that. Even you can find a way of even I don't know how to put it without coming out with cliches, but cliches are sort of pre-digested thought put into a pre-digested phrase, and the key is always not to pre-digest it, to have the thought originally for the first time, not to have it filtered through anyone else's perception. It was an interesting thing that Alan Corran, the writer, the comedy writer, used to, that his daughter Victoria quoted, that he'd say that if you've got a subject, don't write down the first thing that comes into your head, because that's what everyone will think of. Don't write down the second thing, because that's what the clever people will think of. Write down the third thing, because that thing is entirely you. So always write down the third thing that comes into mind. I mean, you know, you can't do it all like that, but that's an interesting strategy.
Absolutely. It's a great thing, I think, for comedians to aspire to as well. And I know a lot of the listenership of this podcast is sort of newer acts.
Yeah.
And
and also avoiding cliche. You know, for example, if I hear a comedian do the following kind of joke, a dyslexia joke.
Yeah.
You know, I've got dyslexia. Like, oh, God, here we go. You know, I believe in dog. Or, you know, you can write them coming out your arse, those jokes. What other ones? There are certain genres of joke that just my heart droops when I hear. And there's just several others I can think of. So I can't at the moment. It's like people, you know, there's always someone who's famously ugly or something, you know, like, and, you know, it would be, you know, so you, in a rule, in a line of three, it would be, Angelina Jolie, Michelle Pfeiffer, and Anne Widdecombe, you know, but Anne Widdecombe, no one should ever mention Anne Widdecombe again. That's what people who aren't comedians think is funny if they're saying something. But we've heard jokes about Anne Widdecombe being ugly. Do someone else.
Yeah.
Pick some other name that everyone goes, oh, blimey, I've never heard of that. Hugh Edwards. You know. I've got the band going now. So come on, baby. If you're a proper stand-up, you recognise... In fact, that's almost the first thing you can ask yourself. Is this what someone who's less talented than me would write?
That chimes with something that Adam Bloom was saying. Adam did one of these interviews, and he was saying that one of his rules... He doesn't have many rules, but one of his rules is if it sounds like anything he's ever heard before, ever, he bins it.
Yeah. Well, that's not bad, yeah. And he has some very sharp lines, Adam.
He really does, yeah.
Yeah.
So is that? Do you have any other rules you can think of that you've always worked to, or any like if you like the journey of you having an idea about, you know, a sign in the Lothian Council tenement?
Yeah.
And you have that idea, you make a note of it, you come back to it X amount of time later. Do you normally, do you try and unpack it? Do you try and do you write around it? What's the process? Do you brainstorm it?
I think what you do is you try ways that you can say it, And say I've got some gag that I want to try out, some thought, some collection of words, and you say it and it doesn't get a laugh. Now, as we know, that in the end, that's all that counts. If they laughed, it's funny. If they didn't, it isn't. And it might not be quite right. So you then got to go back. You could try, it's odd how just like losing a word or slightly rephrasing something can release it and make it funny. Something I remember trying one recently. I discovered that predictive texting. That's a little bit predictable as well, actually. But I said to my oh, my partner sent me a text using predictive texting saying, "Can you get some scousers to clean the kitchen?" And do you know what I love about that line is there's always a beat and where. There's nothing, no one laughs. It's always a laugh that comes a beat after.
Sure.
I like doing those kind of ones. But anyway, sometimes a joke finds its time. I remember I used to compare a lot of the Comedy Store in the early days. And I remember I had this joke about, I hated disc jockeys in the morning being so kind of jolly. And I tried a routine around it, but it hadn't really gone anywhere. But then about 2 years later, somehow this came up, disc jockeys in the morning or something, whatever. And I then had lived this gag that had not gone well before. But because I was in full flow, I said it in the right way.
Yeah.
And it got laughs.
Yeah.
And then it led me to improvise a couple more lines. I mean, I think that's something that's always worth doing. If you've got a great joke, there's another laugh waiting if you want somewhere, sure. Probably. If you can get one on top of that, and then ideally, obviously, so that it goes into a whole routine. But often, if an audience has laughed a lot at one line, you should look out for a little additional line that's going to liberate another laugh that's kind of, it's almost a free laugh if you can find it.
Mm. I think that's...
Sometimes not as brave as I'd like. I mean, sometimes to delay the laugh so that the audience are almost in pain waiting for it can work. When I did this Leonard Cohen show, because it was called Arthur Smith Sings Leonard Cohen, as far as anyone knew,
Title like that, you've given yourself license to do that and then just go, well, what did you expect?
Exactly. And at first I thought, maybe that's what I'll do. I wasn't brave enough to just sing Leonard Cohen songs. So I thought, nevertheless, Leonard Cohen is not the most upbeat, comical kind of singer, although he is actually very cool. Anyway, that's another story. But so I came on very earnestly and started singing Suzanne. And then I said, with guitar gently going under, I first became aware of Leonard Cohen when my brother came down from university with his records when I was at school, and we listened to them together, and they were wonderful. And I remember then I felt I had a problem with my brother, who was a straight-ace kind of a guy. But then when we listened to Leonard Cohen for the first time in my life, I felt really close to him. I never felt close to him again because 2 weeks later he was killed in a car crash. And then I said, and that's how I would have started this show if my brother had been killed. So I went, and it was, the relief of the audience.
Of course, yes.
The release that, thank Christ, he's not now going to do an hour's show reminiscing about his dead brother.
Because you could be. That could be the show absolutely. We're all there to see. It's a perfect setup. It's a...
As far as they were concerned, that's what it was going to be right up until that moment. And there were no laughs. And I always remember being very, very proud that I think I was 2 minutes, 40 seconds before that laugh.
That's good.
That was a long time. To go, as to be honest, you go 30 seconds without a laugh, you're beginning to worry normally.
Yeah.
This is a standard rate, it's about one every 15 seconds, isn't it? Laugh a minute, that's not enough.
No, absolutely. You talked before about sometimes when you're flowing, the stuff just comes out. Yeah. Do you ever try and artificially recreate that when writing?
Well, I mean, one way of doing it is to just keep writing. I mean, they sometimes say to people who are is to have blocked. One way to cope with, you know, either you can't leave anything to write, you know, the terror of the blank page. One way of going about it is just to sit and write anything at all, just like, I am writing this down now because I want to, and eventually it might release it. But of course, there are times when you feel inspired for no real apparent reason. And there are other times when, however hard you try, you're not getting it. I remember Eddie Braben, who used to write Morgan and Wise, talked about sitting at the typewriter for 3 days in a row, having not writing a word. You can't really induce it, I don't think. Well, I can't, sure. And I don't think many people can. So you can sort of bash away at it, and then bang, a little moment of light will come into your rather dull monologue. And then, even if you've just got that, then it was worth doing. But you have to accept, I think, as a writer, there will be days, there may be weeks, and if you're really unlucky, there will be months and years where you just can't fucking get anything that's any good.
And do you still, in those circumstances, do you still try? Are you a disciplined writer, or have you been throughout your career to go, right, I'm going to get up at this time and I'm going to write for X amount of hours?
Of course not. I've always been, I've always fancied myself as a bit of a lazy, I'll get away with it kind of dude. I mean, there have been times, I mean, if you've got a if you've got a deadline, there's nothing quite concentrates the mind like that. If sure. I think, oh, right, in 2 hours I've got to go and do 10-minute stand-up, which I've never done before, I would immediately say, right, Stuart, I've finished here, I've got to go. And then nothing like, you know, it's like, you know, nothing like the prospects of being executed the next day to concentrate your mind. So I was like, get a deadline, even if you don't really need one. The trouble is, you can say, well, I could really actually do it on Monday.
Yeah, it's difficult to face a deadline, isn't it?
I don't consider myself to be a very hard worker. And in some senses, I think of myself as an amateur, you know, a dilettante, which is perhaps why I'm not as rich and famous as I might be, but, you know, that's fine. I like to hang loose. And as I say, since inspiration sort of floats around, like happiness, you know, happiness is something. It comes on you unexpectedly, mostly. You can plan. I mean, there's nothing worse. This is why New Year's Eve is always so shit, because everyone's like, oh, I'm going to that party, or whatever. Yeah. Everyone's expecting to have a good time, and nothing less likely. But that unexpected, spontaneous afternoon where you went down a pub with friends, that's happiness. And inspiration's the same. It kind of floats around a bit.
Have you ever been concerned that you're going to run out of funny? Do you ever felt it's a finite resource?
Well, I think everyone fears that. It's like I've often seen stand-ups who've become very successful and then gone into something else, and then they haven't done it for 6 months. And there's no one more terrified than that.
They know what the thing is, but they don't know if they can get back there.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I don't really. You know, I've always been naturally a little bit of an outsider, an archetype, a creature who's not exactly doing the same as the other ones, and that is my nature. So I don't really, I do fear actually that I can't write as perhaps with such intensity as I did in my 30s, maybe, when I wrote all these plays. And I'm quite happy to, you know, sometimes I'm not ambitious in that sense. I've got to do that now. I mean, you look at someone like Eddie Izzard, and I'm amazed by him. He's amazing. Yeah. You know, he's doing a gig in, I did a gig in French long before Eddie, but I can speak French.
Yeah, fine.
He can't really, but, you know, a man that could do 37 marathons in a row or something.
Yeah,
I mean, that is driven, and I've never been driven. To be honest, I don't want to swim across the Atlantic. I don't, you know, and you know, I'm not bothered if I don't, to be honest. But having said that, you know, I want to keep going, and I have a need to perform in some extent, as I have a need to write.
That's what I was going to ask. I mean, you don't seem to be planning to retire at any point. Are you going to keep going till you drop?
Well, don't be in the outline of business, as you'll find out, Stu. It doesn't. I mean, you are retired, maybe, by indifference. But
No, I mean, if I even if I retired, I'd just end up doing weird shows for no money, you know, probably. You know, whether it's we're lucky in our line of work because you don't start doing it unless in some way you love it. And to do what you love and to be able to carry on doing it is, you know, the greatest aim you can have professionally. Apart from the money and that, but, you know, I was never that bothered about that song.
Arthur Smith, you said you've got to go. If I can keep talking for as long as you can, but if you've got other if you've got other commitments, I'll let you go.
Stuart, you're dumped. Well, thank you for the afternoon.
Thank you very much.
So that was Arthur. I got loads out of that. And I think at the time I was really sort of entranced. And obviously when I'm interviewing, I'm thinking about lots of other things about sort of editing and future stuff like that. But only really just re-listening to that just now and editing it, I'm just really touched by this idea, in particular this idea that inspiration floats around like happiness. I think that's absolutely beautiful. What a master. Two little adverts before we finish. I'm doing a preview of my Edinburgh show Prick in Derby at Bar One in Derby on the 22nd of July. You can get details and tickets there at funhousecomedy.co.uk. And if you get there, I think I'm on at 6 or 6:30, but it's an all-day festival of Edinburgh previews. So if you get there, you can see the Scottish Falsetto Sock Puppet Theatre, I think they're called. And then from 3:20, if you were to get there at 3:20, you could see the fabulous Andrew Bird, Jigsaw, which is, you'll probably remember, is Dan Antopolsky's sketch outfit. Then it's me, and then Loretta Main, and then I think The Noise Next Door, all in one go. If you're anywhere near Derby, go there on the 22nd of July. In Reading, on the 25th of July, I'm going to be at Coyote Comedy. If you go to coyotethinking.co.uk, that's a new comedy club at the Rising Sun pub in Reading, and that's going to be one of my final previews of Prick. So anywhere near Reading, get along to that on the 25th of July. Thank you for listening this far. Final reminder, comedianscomedian.com/Sarah. That's where you can get the extras from the Sarah Millican podcast. And I'm really looking forward to next time in 2 weeks. That's going to be the last one before I break for Edinburgh, when I'm going to hopefully be talking to one of the unsung heroes of the UK comedy circuit, an incredible compere and a comedy writer and performer with a unique and wonderfully gentle style, which is, of course, Mr. Alan Cochran. So we'll no doubt be talking about hard work and happiness and a genuine love of comedy. Alan was kind of a mentor figure for me, in that he was already up and running and a friend of mine by the time I started doing stand-up. So I owe a great deal to Alan. I'm really looking forward to talking to him. Until then, goodbye. Thanks for listening. Speak to you soon.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.